This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today, we take a guided tour through the most recent edition of Monocle magazine, if you've heard of it, our July-August summer special with the ever-dapper Jamie Waters.
The athleisure industry is massive, and it's that is a sector in itself, and I don't think that will go away because I think it's so connected with how people live now.
Also ahead.
So I created my theory or my approach by observing life in India. And so the kind of thing that I do don't follow the norm that has been written or typed or talked about.
We listen back to a discussion with Indian architect B.V. Doshi, the man whose eye for modernism has helped shape some of the nation's most eye-catching buildings and even scooped him a Pritzker Prize in the process. Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. We begin rather close to home here on Monocle's editorial floor at Midori House in leafy Marylebone. Our editors and correspondents have been busy crossing T's, dotting I's, and yes, even crossing some of their own I's as we finish the first instalment of four bumper summer newspapers, available each Thursday throughout August. Seeing the summer season out in style means getting some tips for must-watch brands and what to buy. And earlier Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters, joined me in studio to talk through some of the sartorial selections on show in the current July-August edition of Monocle magazine.
So I'm excited about the lead, which is basically about cool sportswear brands. We kind of shot it on models, kind of action style shots, and it's basically like fairly comprehensive guide to the best clothes to wear for four different sports. So we've got cycling, running, swimming, and gym. We cover sportswear, and obviously in the fashion industry, sportswear, streetwear have all kind of become blended in and have become a very fashionable thing and have kind of been, you know, appropriated by a lot of bigger brands. You know, they all do sportswear and hoodies and all that sort of thing. What we focused on, like, proper hardcore sportswear brands that are really like, they're doing like proper trail running shoes, they're doing all the, you know, high tech, breathable, waterproof, etc., etc. So all the kind of very technical things, they've got a kind of stylish flair. So if you want like a high vis vest for your amateur cycling career, but you still want to look pretty good, you know, we've got the brands for you. So that's our lead, and I think it looks cool, and I think there's a lot of sort of nice things to buy there. And
well, God, you know me so well for my love of sportswear. When we talk about fashion, you know, is that trend, is that idea that you can wear sportswear all day from the moment you get up to when you do your shopping to going to work. Is that had its moment in the fashion world, or are we still seeing a lot of that?
We're still seeing a lot of it. I mean, I think the, like, athleisure, you know, kind of an annoying word, but it is what the athleisure industry is massive. That is a sector in itself, and I don't think that will go away because I think it's so connected with how people live now. So I think it's more than a trend, because now, apart from anything else, they want really comfortable clothes that they can just wear around and feel a bit active and, you know, just feel a bit good about themselves. I think it's more than a trend. I think that will stay around. But I think what we were keen to do is focus more on brands, as I said, that are kind of more sportswear. Athleisure is such a murky thing because, you know, it's quite easy for brands now to be like a fashion brand, but to do a hoodie and say, well, this is athleisure. Whereas I think we wanted people that are like, no, actually, we're looking at really technical materials. And so I wouldn't call these athleisure brands. I think these are sportswear brands.
Okay, an important definition to make. And we move on from sportswear to a sole trader of sorts. You've honed in on a shoe company. And it's perhaps not the shoe company that people would expect. You know, in Monocle, we don't really go in for high fashion, we go in for provenance, we go in for good storytelling. And I think this shoe is a bit of a kind of strange wonder in that world from an orthopedic background, am I right?
Yeah, so this flows quite nicely from that point about athleisure versus sportswear. This is a shoe brand called Lunge, and it's German. It's a German brand. They're interesting because it's founded by two brothers who are, one of them is a former marathon runner. And I think that, you know, they take their shoes and they're running very seriously. I think they're quite nerdy about their kind of approach, very technical. They're one of those interesting brands that has kind of, you know, there's this type of brand that has kind of profited from the whole athleisure movement and the sportswear becoming fashionable movement. And they're kind of these unlikely fashion favorites at the moment where they're kind of these very technical, quite nerdy kind of sportswear brands that suddenly fashionistas are really interested in because they're very technical and these brands take them, you know, take things very seriously. This particular brand, Lunge, everything is made on site in its factory in a rural province, not a rural town, not too far from Hamburg. It's all kind of, it's done very seriously. It's more about the actual function of the shoes than about the style. But they've become these kind of unlikely fashion icons. They have sold in Dover Street Market, in kind of agenda-setting shops in London and in New York. But they also sold in like medical orthopedic shops across Germany. And I think that's their bread and butter. So there's kind of, it's this funny thing in fashion where a lot of the like most fat, like, you know, fashionable brands in inverted commas actually take things very seriously, are quite almost medical and nerdy in their functionality, and are actually not concerned with the fashion pack at all. They don't covet this attention, but they've sort of become style stars because of the industry's, you know, fascination with technical, good quality products.
I love that. And that gives me hope that there is also some substance behind some of the style. We move on next. You hopped on the Eurostar. You went down to meet Pierre Hardy, who is the creative director of Hermès Shoes. But I'd like to know what shoes you wore to interview him.
It's a good question. And I was conscious of this. I'm quite boring, but I wore some Chelsea boots, which were not designed by him.
Bit of structure, you meant business. You were sure-footed.
Yeah, they were. They're solid shoes, and they're not controversial. And he did have a look at what I was wearing. He said it was almost a bit of an illness. He couldn't stop looking at people's shoes all the time. And as he said that, he kind of glanced down at mine. But he
with a wry smile on his face, or with a look of appreciation.
He said they were nice. He didn't chuckle to himself or anything. I think they sort of passed.
Thanks, Jamie. That was our fashion editor, Jamie Waters. The July-August edition of Monocle magazine is on sale now. And just remember that Monocle's summer weekly newspapers will hit newsstands from Thursday and are available each week in August. Do stay with us as we'll be revisiting a favourite discussion from the show after this with one of the most revered figures in modernist architecture. It's only B.V. Doshi. Balkrishna Doshi, known simply as B.V. Doshi for people reading his name on the radio, was awarded architecture's highest honour, the Pritzker Prize, in 2018. Now in his 90s, the maestro's oeuvre includes the boxy concrete designs that have shaped a generation of buildings in his native India. They've ranged from schools in Bangalore to affordable housing in the centre of the country. B.V. Doshi's long, oh-so-long career has seen him work with icons of the art from Le Corbusier to Louis Kahn. The thread that unites all of Doshi's work, you ask? A rare generosity and commitment to democratising design, we say. Monocle's Thomas Lewis met him to talk about his career.
You know, there is so much to do in our own country. It's not a small place. It's a continent, large population, and a billion people. So billion people with billion aspirations. So if one wants to do work, you don't need to go out. The market is full of people and their aspiration. And each region has different characteristics. So if I want to work in India, I have innumerable choices. If I go to south, I see a very different world. If I go to north, northeast, west, another world. So if I have that kind of a choice, not traveling much. And second thing is because we are not technologically highly technical, the regional characteristics can be expressed through local things. And that gives me a satisfaction that I have done something which will appear rooted to the place. And I think that rooting is very important for me, that it doesn't look like an outside. It should give a sense of timelessness. And that is what I am interested in, that if you go to a place in India, and when you go to the deserts and you see the mud houses and beautifully done, if I have to do a building there, it should merge with it. And that is quite different from a metropolis. So choices I have many. Opportunities are many. So I don't need to go out.
You mentioned during your lecture about creating spaces where surprises could happen, and that had imbued itself in projects from university campuses to, I think it was a business complex, to a water tower even. Why is the notion of a built environment being a canvas for surprises and for life to unfold so important to you, I suppose, in your work? But also, do you think that's something that you have seen in other architectural practices elsewhere? Is there a sense that, you know, sometimes architecture can box us in? And is that something you were sort of pushing against?
I think sense of belonging is very important. And sense of belonging can only come when you connect them through the emotional values of the people. Second thing is participation. The third issue is familiarity, yet it is something slightly different. So that enigma has to come in. And I think that I find in India very important, especially when large population is there, which has different kind of cultural backgrounds. And if they come there, then the whole question is, how would the spaces and form or space, light or values be seen? And I think nature also in India plays a very important role. Very harsh light or soft light. Landscape changes. People are different things. And so if you see examples of the Hindu temples, I think temples are great examples because you all the time feel movement, change, and affinity. And I think that is something which I think I try to do in the work. And that fascinates me because it is in this place, it's only chance. Also, the technology that I use is not really in terms of very modern or something, because I thought that I would like to make a lot of diversities, variations. So if you use a technology and if you want to talk about productive technology, then one doesn't get that sense of that little variation. Like if you walk on the streets, you find so many kinds of faces, so many dresses, so many languages, so many gestures. Now, is it possible that we can make a building like the beings? So I tried to create a static theater of Indian culture.
You worked famously with many of the great figures of architecture in the 20th century, Le Corbusier being among them. What struck me during your lecture was, I suppose, the intimacy of that relationship. One thing, I suppose, that to perhaps a layperson about his body of work is that there was a sort of element, I suppose, of prescription, of deciding that this was a new way of living and that this is how a new way of life should be lived. It strikes me that your work is quite different to that. You spoke about your vast work in social housing and that at the heart of those designs was this sense that the people who lived there should be able to build on top of what you'd designed. Yes. Was there any tension there between you and Le Corbusier, or was his thinking something that was a bit of a springboard to your mind of the flexibility that architecture could have?
Actually, I knew Corbusier, I can't say very closely, but reasonably closely. And my relation with him was almost like my grandparent, you know. So learning from him, talking to him, and if I did something, then he would come and draw and change and tell me about India. He was the first one to tell me about India and Indian life. He said, you know, in your country, have you noticed the birds fly through the house? Have you noticed the trees and the wind? How harsh the sun is. And then he would point out people there and he says, this is really strong, but this is really very soft. So he says, don't you see the dynamic balance? Then he would say that if you have to eat food, it may be good that sometimes in one place there is more salt and in the other part there is no salt. Now he would talk to me like this. So if he was telling me this way, what better lesson I can get? But to understand this and transfer this into life, transfer it into work, transfer it into my kind of idea, that paradox, choice, variety, and the game that you play and the delight that you get out of changing situations And I think this is what I learned from him. So for me, he was that kind of a person. Similarly, Louis Kahn, when he came, I worked with him close to 12 years. I don't think people in Philadelphia work that long. So I had a stretch of time with him. And the 1 week that he would come, almost full day I would be with him. So he would talk about the break. Then he would talk about Arabian Nights. He would talk about food. He would talk about what is purity. And then I would take him to old houses. I would take him to a temple and a mosque. And we would talk about the spirituality of matter, simplicity of structure. So we talked about many things together. So there was a dialogue which was quite good. And I think it was very amazing that I had that, what you call privilege, that I talked to him and they talked to me as if that they were giving me guidance. So they became my guides. And so the only way was, having got this kind of information, the insight, how would I express it and what is my background? So anything that I was doing came from these two combinations, and naturally what I do has to be close to my work. And that is the only reason why the work is different.
I was interested to look at, staying with the idea of housing with such a prominent social component as you've become so known for, you showed some of these complexes when they were first built and when you designed them, and you also showed them during the lecture this week how they are now. And this notion of the owners have built and added and painted and changed and shops have opened and life has kind of woven itself through. I'm interested to know about notions of control from your point of view as the architect. Is it difficult to design something where at the very core of the design you are relinquishing control, and that that's where the sort of heart of the design lies, is that you want the people who use and live in these buildings to create something of their own from it?
You know, in India, the aesthetic sense is very, very different. We don't have that kind of formulation of aesthetics. Aesthetics is a living entity. It is not a frozen thing. So the Indian theory is that all the human beings have different emotions, and you can express many emotions. The way you express is very important. So the whole question of aesthetics and architecture has to be of a kind or of one kind, as if it is a religion. I think that doesn't exist in Indian culture. It is the delight that is important, not the kind of formulation. So if you have an Indian plate to eat, you get variety of it, and then you choose the way to mix it to your way. So you are satisfied through your combination and giving your delight that you were seeking. While in the European dish, you will not get that choice. It is the cook and the chef who has done it. And the way it is presented to you, you have to take it that way. I think this is a fundamental difference between the notion of aesthetics between the East and the West. And I think I was trying to find out, if that is the case, then isn't it possible, like in Indian music, that you can combine and then play the game so that you will get what we call a jugalbandi, the kind of dialogue or the duet, which orchestrates in a very different way. And then, you know, you find that that is something very beautiful. So my effort has been to give only hint and let the choice be with the onlooker or the person who is relishing it.
Is that something, looking at architecture in India now, it's a country with an economy that's booming for many people, I suppose not for everybody. In terms of the architecture that's being built for a country that is going through so many dramatic changes on so many levels, are you sort of energized or concerned about maybe, you know, with wealth, with development, with opportunity, are there architectural ideals that are being relinquished just from your vantage point? Or is there something in the architecture that's happening there now, in the development that's happening across the country now, that chimes with some of the ideas you've expressed throughout your career?
I think this is a very difficult thing that is happening. Unfortunately, I had the grace of having those two masters, and the other one was that I was not fully educated in architecture or anything. So I have a vague notion of what the reality is or what theory is. So I created my theory or my approach by observing life in India. And so the kind of thing that I do don't follow the norm that has been written or typed or talked about as the meaning of aesthetics or meaning of a particular character. Either it is a reinterpretation of function or technology or the kind of space we do. Other thing is that in the kind of visits that I have done to Indian villages and towns and cities, I have seen people using spaces which are not informed. They are really free and you choose them the way they want. Or you give them a choice and it becomes something else. So transformation, according to us, is the law of nature. So they get transformed, they get changed, because they want them to become part and parcel of whole. So the architectural practice that is happening today in India is not like this. It is the way anywhere else it is done, because they don't think like this. They think as an architect who has to have certain ways, certain aesthetics, certain functions. And so they do like that, in which what they have learned, what they have seen in the world, they think that is what they want to do. So they are following that kind of pattern. I am following a pattern which is my own, from the two great masters, but again my own in India, trying to really create and discover for myself whether I am understanding really India or not. So it is not meant for demonstration. It is my exploration of thinking that this is perhaps the approach that we should have to give us our own identity and connect us through our sensibilities. So it is really talking matter versus soul. I work with the other, the soft aspect.
And I suppose you're saying, therefore, that the harder aspects,
yes,
money, finance,
yeah,
those things,
exist.
No. I wanted to ask you briefly, I know our time together is coming to a close. The Venice Biennale this year is looking at notions of free space and interpreting that pretty broadly, I think it's fair to say. What do those words put together mean to you, free space? It seems to me that it is a phrase that resonates quite clearly in a big diversity of your work. What do you think that means today?
Well, it is now coming to the idea that how does one give freedom? Free space is really giving freedom within a certain confinement. And this is a very ancient view. Even if you go to Venice, you will find that kind of a thing happening. There are so many accidental spaces that have happened. It is like we are discovering now, after so centuries, after working with our mechanical ways, we are trying to say, oh my God, but this is something which is liberating us. So my interpretation is that the free space is the attempt to liberate us from the kind of confines that we are traditionally taught. So it is loosening up the attitude on the judgment of what is aesthetics, what is plan, what is function. I think we talk about them in singular ways, but actually each word has to have a lot of plural meanings. And I think those plural meanings are now becoming apparent slowly. We are awakening to plurality, not singularity.
And where are you seeing that plurality opening up, would you say, from your role as a teacher, I suppose? But are there any sort of cities or developments or areas of the world, corners of India, that you're seeing, a sense of an opening up and maybe a pursuit again of imagination in architecture rather than the sort of hard commercial aspects, I suppose, you're alluding to?
I tell you, one of the most fascinating cities in India is Varanasi, Banaras, very ancient city. Fully crowded, full of religions, full of feelings, full of emotions, and lot of unmeasurable impact. And I think that is really where the things are, that we are still away from our soul, our inner consciousness. We are still talking as if, you know, that we are talking from our head, body, or the rationale of living. And I think that is where the difference is. We should not really talk about all the time the measurable, the rational, the conventional, in a sense, that what is correct is correct, what is right and wrong. I think there is nothing like right and wrong. It's a completely fluid aspect because it goes from one end to the other, and it is like a glide, you know, you slide slowly from one end to the other end. And for me, I think architecture and life, they also must go like that slide. They go together, and without knowing, they reach a destination which they had not expected.
BV Doshi there, speaking to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis. That's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear more design-minded stories, you could always subscribe to this show or our Natalie named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra. How do we come up with it? That's available each Thursday. You could also pick up the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is on all good newsstands now. Monocle on Design was produced by Tom Hall. It was edited by Steph Chung Gu. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.